Well, who feels better after that? For our German speakers in the room, evidently there's a transcript available afterwards. That's Carl Sagan. In 1980, he released a TV miniseries called Cosmos, A Personal Voyage. And it's a naturalist or materialist manifesto. That is, a person who believes there is nothing more than what can be seen, touched, heard, measured. Nothing else exists. And this is what life comes to. His series was wildly popular when it was released. And in fact, just a couple of years ago, Neil deGrasse Tyson, a major American physicist, re-released it, remixed it, and opened with the same beginning lines to let us know that he was going to give us the same worldview that Sagan had given us 38 years ago. Cosmos is all there ever is and all there ever will be. Sagan's series begins with a photo or a video taken from outer space in that blank darkness where there's just dots of stars in the distance, and there's one speck in particular which he points to, a pale blue dot. And this is referred to as his pale blue dot speech. And his purpose is to show how small, how insignificant Earth is in the vast darkness that surrounds it. How if we just have the right perspective, we'll see how insignificant all of humanity is. Astronomy, he says, is humbling and character building because there is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. What is man's conceit? To think himself significant in any way. In other words, Sagan asks of everybody, who do you think you are? Let me just review a couple of the things he says in this video. Surely nobody could have imagined that life would arise and thinking beings evolve who would one day capture a fraction of that light and would try to puzzle out what sent it on its way. In other words, we're here by chance, completely arbitrary. It didn't have to be that way. And he suggests if it wasn't, it would be just as good. We seem compelled to project our own nature onto nature. Man, in his arrogance, thinks himself a great work worthy of the interposition of a deity. In other words, it's a figment of our imagination to give ourselves significance that we create a God who would condescend to us. Darwin wrote in his notebook to consider himself created from animals. And then we live in the cosmic boondocks, emerging from microbes in muck. It's not enough that we're insignificant, but in this great universe, we are on the edges of it. If there was anybody there to care, they wouldn't care at all. We are lost in a great darkness, and there's no one to send out a search party. Given so harsh a reality, of course, we're inclined to shut our eyes and pretend that we're safe and snug at home, that the fall from significance is only a bad dream if it takes a little myth and ritual to get us through at night, that a night that seems endless. Who among us cannot sympathize and understand? I think you understand from those words what he thinks of religion. We long to be here for a purpose, but even our self-deception cannot produce one. The significance of our lives and our fragile planet is then determined by our own wisdom and courage. We're custodians of life's meaning. And modern science has been a voyage into the unknown with a lesson in humility waiting at every stop. We do not live in a privileged frame. What we experience at the end of Sagan's explanation, and he feels he's being fully honest to the cold, hard truth, is that we are all alone. We are alone on this earth, trapped on it, in a hostile and fatal surroundings of space, which would leave us breathless and frozen. We can't get off this planet, but we're even lonely between one another. because we share no common meaning. There is nothing we can share in common in terms of meaning. There is only the meaning you find for yourself. He even describes Earth in the way he does, a pale blue dot. Not a bright blue dot, which would have promise and hope, but a planet of languishing, fading life that will soon be gone. And he boasts that we must have humility. And for him, what humility means is we must accept that none of us matters. We've been in a series about our church and where we are at the moment, where we're going. That series has come to a close, and I'm beginning a new one today. And I think that Nick was a good segue to that, in that it's a series on the gospel. What is the gospel? I want to make sure you know that, and I want to make sure that as a church we discuss that. The very basics of it. And the place that I see to begin in the gospel is to begin at the beginning, which we'll do in a moment. But I want you to know that coming out of the series we just came out of, as elders, we are going to continue pursuing what we talked about. Who we are, where we're heading, and especially how we leave room for God to the next step that he'll take us on. And I also want to produce kind of a summary of what we went through that all the body can have access to. Suggestions for how we do that together. Just a very starting point of how we can do that together, as well as the challenging questions that came up so you can review them for yourself. But today we turn to the beginning. Now, much of what Sagan said today in that video has plagued the West for centuries. It's not as though he produced this worldview. He did popularize it, for one, through this TV series. But he is the product of forces that have long been in the making in our culture in Europe and North America. Francis Schaeffer referred to it as the line of despair, that there was a point in time in Europe in the 1890s and in North America in the 1935 when, whether we saw it or not, our culture fell into despair. I've mentioned to you before, and we won't spend much time on this, but I do want to give you a background, a philosophy called existentialism, which sounds really, really imposing, and maybe you want to glaze your eyes over for a moment, but it's not that hard to understand. Existentialism is the surprise of finding yourself conscious in a world and then trying to figure out what you're supposed to do with it. What is this thing anyways? And who am I? And what do I do? And the key answer to that that makes a perspective existential is that by reason we can find no meaning in life. Only by the irrational. Only by a feeling or something that can't be put into words. And so I've mentioned to you before a Danish philosopher and theologian named Kierkegaard, who was the father of this movement, because he felt that faith was something completely other than reason, which I disagree with him on. Completely other. And so he looks at the story of Abraham and Isaac and how Abraham took Isaac up that mountain, but before he went up, he said to his servant, "Me and the boy will go and we will return." And Kierkegaard says, Abraham knew what was going to happen on that mountain. He was going to sacrifice his son and he was willing to do it. It's totally irrational for him to say, "And we will come down," but that's what he believed. And so faith is that belief. He calls faith absurd. Not because it's wrong, but because you can't explain it. It can't be defined by words and reason. And they did come back down, proving that faith, the absurd, has to be part of finding meaning and significance in this life. After Kierkegaard, there are a number of philosophers whose names you don't know, but who have impacted your life more than you could imagine, and whose ideas we are interacting with in culture every single day, who took up Kierkegaard's mantle but denied the existence of a God. One of them was a Swiss philosopher named Jaspers. He sought for meaning, and where he found it was in an experience he had one day where he just knew. He knew that he was meaningful. It just happened. He couldn't put it into words. He couldn't explain it. It can't be explained. It's just self-evident. Another was a German philosopher named Heidegger. His was not nearly so enjoyable. His experience was not, I matter because I had this experience like Jasper, but his experience was dread. Humans know they exist and live because there's this looming sense of dread over all of us. Another cold, hard truth he would encourage us towards. It's not fear, because fear has an object. You're afraid of a wolf or a lion, but dread is just anxiety because you're alive. And that's how you know you're alive. Two French philosophers, Sartre and Camus, they suggested that really a human being can't find any meaning, there's no such thing, but they can exert themselves in the world. And that's all that matters. We can authenticate ourselves, they said, because I can make a choice and then I can act it out and the world will change because I acted out my choice. I've left an impression in the world. Therefore, I am. I had a friend in graduate school who studied Camus, looking to Camus for answers. And she was not halfway through her PhD before she ended her life. I'm convinced that there is a connection. And finally, we have another attempt entirely, yet connected, by men like Aldous Huxley, who maybe you've read his work, A Brave New World. In the 1930s and on, he was an author in England and something of a philosopher. And he decided that the best way, at least he concluded, the best way he'd experienced to find meaning was through drugs. As long as I'm high, I feel like I matter. And it was a very honest attempt at finding meaning in the world. At the risk of boring you a bit, this philosophy dripped into every aspect of society. At first, it was through artists. You'll know some of their names. Van Gogh, Gauguin, Cézanne, Picasso, who started a movement of art called Impressionism, in which you couldn't distinguish one character from another. You couldn't tell who you were looking at because they were searching for a universal, not a single person, but what is a person? And behind it all was this urgency in their hearts and minds. And why do I matter? Soon they found that people can't have meaning. And so they began to make people indistinguishable from objects. Maybe if we reduce it just to existence itself, we'll find some meaning. And they could not. Today, we see it rampant through our entertainment. I noticed a difference when I was about 16 or 17 years old, that movies stopped being about anybody winning and started being about everybody just getting used to the way things are. That's the most a human can hope for. Or how romance changed. A romantic movie or romantic comedy today, I think we still find that true love, that life-enduring love, is still the highest aim that people wish for, but it's unrealistic. It won't happen. And so we see today that in romantic comedies, the message is enjoy who you're with while you're with them, because it's the best you're going to get. What we see in our own society is one of boredom, one of drift, one dreary of life, and one which finds the only answer to be what all of these philosophers and artists and so forth have given us. The one place where we feel we matter is in pleasure. Find as much pleasure as you can while you can. It's the closest thing to meaning you're going to get. The problem with that, though, is that as soon as pleasure comes, it's gone. And then we're left without meaning again. What these people describe is an attempt to come to terms with human life on our own. Just the human, all by himself or herself. The human is the measure of meaning. The human's experience is how they measure meaning. The human is essentially God. And they conclude that meaninglessness cannot be denied, but we can perhaps avoid it for a time until we can't anymore. You know, these were the kind of cynical perspective that they had in the ancient world as well. If you read history, you come to the conclusion we haven't changed much. It's still the same problems at our heart that bug us. And many of the same answers. Pleasure was the answer in the ancient world as well. What Sagan offered us is what's called a cosmogony. Cosmos meaning universe, Genesis meaning beginning, the beginning of the universe and everything that entails. And in the ancient world, they formed their own cosmogonies that were to explain their own ideals. So, for example, in modern day Iraq, then known as Mesopotamia, a group of writers produced an epic called the Enuma Elish. And in this story, the way the world begins is that there's these gods that exist, one of them being Marduk. And Marduk is in a battle with Tiamat, the mother ocean figure. And he kills her. He wins. And he tears her body apart. And he throws it into the sky and everywhere it will land. And so earth is created and heavens are created out of her corpse. And then he takes her co-conspirator and kills him too. And he drains the blood from the corpse and there's blood clots in it. And he says, I've got an idea for these clots. I'm going to make human beings. And those human beings are going to serve me so I don't have to do any work from now on. And this is the beginning of humanity for the Mesopotamians. You can imagine what leadership looked like in their culture if that's what humans were made for. Blood I will mass, he says poetically, and cause bones to be. I'll establish a savage man shall be his name. Verily, savage man I will create. He will be charged with the service of the gods that they might be at ease. This was common to all the stories of the time, all their explanations of why we lived on earth. We come from violence. We come from chaos and senselessness. We come from the vulgar, the selfish, the whims of the gods, the ambitions of the gods. We're born in strife and we live in strife. And frankly, when that was their experience in life, it made sense to explain our beginnings that way. They would have said, like Sagan, what we have to do is accept the cold, hard truth. Life is terrible. We are meaningless. Just come with me and grow despairing. We'll drink it away. Then we find Genesis. A book which was produced in that setting. And for a long time, scholars have noticed that it seems deliberately to allude to events in the other stories, to draw them into its own story. Why? To subvert them. To tell them, we have the same elements, but the outcome is completely different. You are completely wrong about everything you've observed. I'm not going to read through it again. Because we've read it already, I'm going to summarize why Genesis 1 matters. But the question I'd ask you before I do that is, do we as Christians really know the significance of what we have in the book of Genesis? Do we really understand what is there? Do we understand why our world needs it? Why we need it? Do we understand what in it contrasts with the stories not just of the ancient worlds, but just as much today with the stories around us? Do we understand why the world would envy that? You know, we have a generation, the first generation, they say today in North America, that has never heard the gospel. The majority of people have never heard the gospel. They don't know who Jesus is except for some political figure. And you know, I look at that as an opportunity. While we're crying about having lost Christendom, these people have never heard hope. You get to be the first to share it with them. And because they haven't been inoculated against it by sitting in a lifeless church because they haven't spent their lives having explained to them why it's wrong. When they hear it, many of them want to hear it. That is so new. I've never thought like that before. Genesis is a response to the existing cosmogonies of its time. It states that far from the way the other stories all begin, every single one of them, there is only one God. Only one necessary existence in existence. He is the source of everything and the only eternal nature that can exist. That means there's no chaos. There's no other gods. There's no one challenging him at the beginning of the world. It means that at the heart of reality is stability and beauty, not chaos and strife. This God, as he created, number one, a creation that's in order within itself, and secondly, that is created in order, not from pulling apart corpses and throwing them willy-nilly, but deliberately planned to be the way that it is. One step at a time, and even literally, as we read this morning, you probably saw there's a pattern that each day is a stanza of a poem. It starts the same, God said, and it ends the same, evening and morning, and it was good. Every little element about this is ordered. It's a moral God, as we see in following chapters, and I'm going to allude to Genesis chapter 2 as well, even though we haven't read it this morning. It's a God who approves of nature at every step. He's in favor of it. He likes it. He's happy with what he's made. And it's a God who produces humankind. He produces them out of love. And what we see is that he loves them so much that in Genesis 2 and 3, he's actually coming down to the garden to walk with him. He creates humanity in dignity, in the image of himself, which might reflect to us many things, but number one, that in some way he wants us to know we're like him. There is a correlation between him and me. He creates us as rulers to carry out his authority, not slaves pressed under it so that he can rest. And then he does a number of things in us that he does with none of the rest of his creation. He breathes his own spirit into us. We are the only ones to receive his spirit. More likeness between us and him. We are the only ones crafted by hand. He doesn't just speak us into being. He takes the clay and he molds it by hand. He has to touch it. He has to be intimate with it. We are the only one, he declares, very good. And so we see that we don't exist despite creation, but that we are the pinnacle of it. Every stage coming before to produce a place where we can live. His jewel. It suggests the highest and greatest dignity in all his creation. In chapter 2, he even brings animals before Adam for his pleasure. He sends this stream of wildlife. Enjoy this, enjoy this, enjoy this. And while none of it can take the place of woman, as any dog or cat or horse lover can tell you, they bring him great joy. The only problem with those animal lovers is when they love their spouse and children less than their animals, or when they dress them in human clothes. That's a no-no too. But there's harmony. And in fact, at this point, humans are vegetarians. Only the plants have been given to them. It won't be for another 8 chapters before they are told to eat of the wildlife. So a lot of scholars conclude that we'll get back to being vegetarians on the new earth. Eat your bacon while you can, just in case it's true. And then he tells them, be fruitful and multiply. In other words, there's not enough of you. I want more. Keep making more for me. Here we are, a creation completely at peace with everything around us. We're abounding in riches and sustenance. God's even sending mists and rivers up to water everything. And he won't plant us in that place until the timing is just right in Genesis 2. He hasn't set them in the garden yet. Hasn't planted the garden because the human's not there. It's got to be just the right time when there will be garden and groomer all at once. Genesis is a wonderful response to the melancholy of the ancient world. Everything about our gospel begins here. It assumes this. And without this, there is no gospel. If God is not alone, he can be challenged. And we might be betting on the wrong horse. It might be that all his promises come to nothing. If we were not so blessed by him, there's nothing to get back to. Why should we expect there is? If he's not approving of us, why would he have goodwill towards us now? If he's not moral, we may not want to get back to him anyways. And if he does not exist in the first place, I have to conclude like Sagan, who is absolutely consistent and thorough in his application of reason. I am insignificant. If there is no God, I have no meaning at all. This is not what our scriptures teach. It's not just in Genesis. We go on to Psalm 139, one of my favorites. And each stanza of Psalm 139 gives us a different perspective about who we are. The first one is that we are objects whom God searches constantly, constantly attentive of us. Starting in verse 1, "You've searched me, Lord, you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out, my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." In other words, there is nothing that God has not searched about you. Tremendously interested in every individual creation. The second stanza is his constant presence. Verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for the darkness is as the light." Constant interest, constant presence. And finally, careful creations. Verse 13, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before the one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you." Here's the explanation David gives for why we have his constant interest and his constant presence. Because we were carefully crafted by him. The other passage that will be very familiar to most of you is the prophet Jeremiah's calling. Right at the beginning of his ministry, as he's called by God, he says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." Our scriptures are very meticulous in communicating that it's not just for the heroes of the faith that these elements are true. Not just for King David, not just for Prophet Jeremiah, not just for Father Adam, but for every one of the creations which descend from Adam and Eve. They are the common inheritance of our race. Every one of us crafted carefully by the Lord, with tremendous care and planning for a future He has for each one of us. Jesus will confirm this in His own ministry. He'll say that God knows the number of hairs on your head. And He came teaching people when they pray to approach God as Abba, Daddy. Something that had been lost among the Jews. Don't you understand? He's a father, and He's an intimate father. And what He wants is intimacy with you. Our scriptures scream, every one of us does have significance. No chance has determined this. There are only dearly loved creations on this earth, crafted with the perfection of an all-knowing, all-capable craftsman to be His own. Now today, as represented by Sagan, our cosmogony has changed. We explain the beginnings of the universe differently, but resulting in the same conclusion, inevitable conclusion, that if there is no God at work in humanity, there is no meaning in humanity, but what we make for ourselves. And of course, anything we make for ourselves is relative, not absolute. Christianity stands on our identity as creations. If it isn't true, there's no hope, there's no gospel. We have to emphasize that what God wants right from our creation was to be known and to know us. The Westminster Catechism, number one, begins, what is the chief end of man? What's his chief goal? Why does he exist? The answer is, as many of you probably know, to glorify God and enjoy Him. This is how we understand our creation, that we glorify God by enjoying Him. Today, because another explanation of human existence exists, jumping to the Jesus story rarely makes sense. But to begin at square one, with our creation, with all that that means, is shocking. The fact is that one of the greatest ins the enemy has in the church is how we tell ourselves terrible lies about ourselves. Terrible lies that completely contradict what is said in the Word about who we are. Guilt is one thing, but we go far further in what we say about ourselves. We agree with the world about our worthlessness, about our hopelessness, about our meaninglessness. There's two things I'd like to communicate to you today. That's number one, that if you don't know Christ, this is where hope begins, in our creation. And number two, if you do know Christ, this is where the gospel stands and is built upon this foundation. One of the things that happens when we come to faith in the Lord is that He challenges how we determine truth. We've seen the way Sagan determines truth by human wisdom and where it leads. Ultimately, it leads to nihilism. But the Word challenges us to trust it as a source of truth. That as we find God, our source of truth is supplanted with His Word. And we speak what He said to us. We repeat it to one another. we remember the testimony he has given by a wisdom far greater than ours. We're going to close in prayer in just a minute. But I hope that throughout the rest of this week and in days to come, you will be certain to put at the foundation of your identity what we've spoken of today. Much of the turmoil that comes in Christians' lives is because they allow their identity to be altered from what the Word says to what they experience in the world. They refuse to accept the testimony of God that we are creations fearfully and wonderfully made with a tremendous plan of salvation ahead of us. Let's close in prayer and I'll invite the worship team back up. Father, this is where your good news begins, and to so many in our world, it truly would be good news to hear and to be able to believe that they are not here by chance, that they are not here meaningless, but that they were crafted and created by a divine being who loves them in perfection. I pray that we as a church take that to heart this morning, that we'd allow nothing to usurp it, and that we wouldn't allow our own hearts, which are back and forth and tossed about with every wave of the sea, to supplant your truth and your testimony to us, Lord, in any way. I pray that we would rest on your truth, we your creations and dearly loved, and that we would share that with our world in ways they see, even if only in our own hope and our own confidence in ourselves as creations of God, our confidence in you for the value you give us. I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen.